Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan.
With insurancebroker.ie.
On News Talk.
You're very welcome back to Lunchtime Live. Anna Daly in for Andrea today. Now, Dr. Nina Burns joins me in studio for our Ask the GP item. So get your questions into us. And if we don't get them this week, we will get them next week. So the text number 087 1400 106. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
The questions are coming in thick and fast. We might as well get stuck in, will we? I'm on 100 milligrams of SSRI for depression, the texter says. I've read online that drinking is not advisable, which is fine as I'm not a big drinker, only very occasionally. However, with the festive season coming up, I feel pressure to explain myself. If not even having one drink and avoiding social events is something I've done in the past due to my illness, and I'd like to try engaging a bit more this year. Is it true about SSRIs and alcohol? They're really looking ahead and planning, which I think is really good, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I find that question really interesting because for me it raises a couple of things. So I know they're asking about SSRIs and alcohol, and I will answer that question. But I think the bigger question that is, why in Ireland do we think if you go out and you don't drink, you have to explain it to
but
people?
But that is the reality.
Yeah, but it's
having
shocking.
Gone through several pregnancies, yeah. Pretending I'm drinking and passing drinks, like it is a real Irish thing, isn't it? What's wrong with you?
But we need to normalise not drinking.
Yeah.
So, you know, first of all, I suppose to answer the question, you can have the odd drink. SSRIs are antidepressants. People might know brand names. Prozac would have been the original. Things like sertraline would be another generic brand. So it's not that you can't drink at all. It's just that because these medications increase a certain neurotransmitter in your brain, and alcohol, remember, is a poison that works in the brain, it also impacts on the brain. And so they don't necessarily work well together. So you would be much more sensitive to the effects of alcohol. You might find you get drunk quicker and you won't even go through that phase of being merry. You might suddenly be drunk and the hangovers might be a lot worse and they can interact negatively. So it's probably okay to have one or two, but, you know, don't go out and do it the first time, maybe if you're at a restaurant or whatever and you eat and have a glass of wine where it releases slower. But I guess I really do think in Ireland, we really need to have this debate about why do people have to make an excuse when they're not drinking alcohol?
You're absolutely right.
You know, one of the fastest growing areas of the drinks industry is non-alcoholic beverages. We need to normalise people going out and saying, I'm not drinking, and they don't have to be driving and they don't have to be pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have
antibiotics.
They don't have to be ex-alcoholics. They can just say, I just don't enjoy drinking or I just don't feel like having a drink. And that should be okay. So to feel like someone is maybe not going to go out or not going to say anything because they don't want to have to explain themselves is really more, a shocking reflection of our society.
Society.
To be honest.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think they're, you know, very positively planning for the future, thinking about Christmas. Christmas in particular. Everything is drinks orientated.
In Ireland.
It really is, though. Do you know?
Yeah, no, it is.
Every meetup is alcohol related.
Yeah. And you know, and it's... Like, obviously, as a GP, I see people from all walks of life, maybe who are, you know, they grew up in families where there was alcohol addiction, or they themselves have been impacted by alcohol addiction, or they're going through various treatments that they don't necessarily want to share with everyone, that maybe they actually can't drink. And yeah, to think that these people stay at home and don't socialise because they just don't want to have to explain themselves. So, you know, we don't go up to, we know that, say, if a woman is married and hasn't had a child, no one's going to go up to someone now and say, when are you having your baby? We know that's not acceptable because it's a really intrusive thing to ask someone. I think we need to make asking someone why they're not drinking equally intrusive. A person should not have to explain to you why they're out in a pub and not drinking alcohol.
Yeah, I completely agree with
you. So I think, you know, for those of you maybe who think of asking that question, my message would be, please don't. It's actually not your
inappropriate
business why someone's not drinking alcohol.
Yeah, and no one should have to explain themselves at all. Okay, the next one. I seem to have tennis elbow, I think, ? The elbow area bone is very painful in general, but doesn't hurt when I'm playing tennis.
So yeah, tennis elbow is a misnomer. So it's lateral epicondylitis is actually the medical term. And so it's kind of the outside of your elbow. There's a nerve runs in that groove. And so it's classically anything you do that encourages you to like that flexion and extension of your arm. So obviously in tennis, there's a lot of whipping the arm around, extending it. But so if you're doing any activity that does that repeatedly, it doesn't have to be tennis. You might get inflammation there. And, you know, a simple thing is actually these to get people to strap their arms, keep them straight for a while. Things like that can help because it takes pressure off the nerve. Anti-inflammatories work for some people. But in a small amount of people, it goes on longer. And actually, occasionally, they do steroid injections into the area. So I would say go back to your doctor, have a chat, see what the options
are. And when you say anti-inflammatories, what are you referring to now?
So the likes of ibuprofen and stuff, if you can take them safely, and even you can buy anti-inflammatory rubs, the old kind of, you know, hot packs, ice packs, anything that reduces inflammation can help in some people.
Okay, good advice. advice. I am in horticulture, and cutting with secateurs is impossible. So painful. Is there anything I can do? I put an ice pack on twice a day and I take ibuprofen. That's from Grace.
So is that the same person or is that another?
I think that's the same person.
Well, yeah, because that would make sense. Horticulture and cutting with the secateurs, because you're going to be in horticulture, you're going to be extending and flexing the elbow a lot. So that's going to flare your tennis elbow. So there you go.
Okay, it is the same person.
It's not the tennis,
it's
the gardening.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. It's the gardening and not the tennis. Yeah. Okay, someone else says, I'm having trouble with calling people I know by the wrong name in conversations. It's on a regular basis. I always correct myself with the correct name. Is there a problem?
It's very hard to answer that question directly with just that. So I would say to you, if that is your only issue in memory and you're not calling other things the wrong name, I wouldn't be overly concerned. But obviously, if you feel that it's a change in your speech, go and have a chat with your doctor. The reason I'm saying that is the part of our brain that very specifically allows us name objects. So, you know, if I look at the table and I see mug and I say mug, actually, when you've had certain strokes in a very localized area of the brain, there's a part of kind of speech changes that'll make you look at that and call it something else.
Okay.
But it wouldn't only affect human names if it was actually an issue with the brain, if that makes sense. So if it's just names, I mean, my family joke, my biggest talent is meeting someone. They tell me their name. In my head, I decide their name is something else and I'll forever call them that name when I meet them. You know, so if it's just names, I wouldn't be so worried. But obviously, you know, I'm sensing that this person maybe has some concerns about memory, and maybe use that as an opening conversation with your doctor to explore it a bit more.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so if it's just names, possibly there's nothing to worry about. Other titles,
if it's like
or
just human
items.
Names, yeah, as
yes.
opposed to naming all kinds of things. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. The very odd time when I'm lying in bed, I get like a swish sound in my right ear. It doesn't happen all the time or regularly, but it happened again two nights ago. And this time it was very loud and only went away when I sat upright. It isn't in a rhythm, just a constant sound when it happens. Should I be concerned?
So obviously, you know, whistling and swishing in your ear can be a thing called tinnitus, which is a ringing in the ear. But I suppose if it's happening just lying on one side and just when you lie down, you do need to go to a doctor and have your blood pressure checked in both arms, actually, and have them have a listen to your neck. Very rarely, if there's a problem with the aorta, which is the main blood vessel that comes up out of your heart and the shape of it going through your chest, if there's any widening or narrowing there, it can cause a kind of a whooshing sound where people describe almost hearing a heartbeat or a whooshing in one ear. It's unlikely to be that, but it's always one of the things you should be checked. So when you go to your doctor, do make sure they check your blood pressure in both arms, because the difference between the two.
That's interesting that you say that. Are you always supposed to have both arms checked?
I suppose in theory, at some point, yes.
Okay.
But if you have narrowing or dilatation, like you can get an aneurysm in your chest, and if you have something going on in the blood vessels in your chest when they come out of your heart, one of the signs will be a significant difference in blood pressure in both your arms. So I suppose as part of a cardiovascular exam, to be honest, if you're doing a proper cardiovascular exam, you are supposed to check blood pressure in both arms at some point and make sure they're the same.
Okay, that's very interesting to me. Where am I now? My teenage son has a cluster of verrucas on his toe. We've tried freezing them to get rid of them, but to no avail. What would you suggest? Would they go away themselves eventually, or do they need to be got rid of?
Verrucas are one of those things
I've had this at
get
home
very
as well.
Upset about. They can be very hard to get rid of, and especially if they're up around the nails and that. You know, there are some studies that suggest that just most of these go away after themselves after several months, but how many months, you know, how long is a piece of string? And the problem is, as well, it's going in one place, it might be coming in another. So the treatments you buy over the counter, the home freezing kits, I just don't find them great. I think if you're doing home treatment, the stuff you buy, the salicylic acid that you paint on, you have to file it every night, like soften the skin, file it every night, paint it on. And you might have to do that for several months. I think people think that's going to go away after a week. The freezing that we do, obviously, in medical clinics, again, it can take quite a few goes. And a really important part of the treatment is actually paring off the dead skin before you freeze it again.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you just freeze over the dead skin, you're not really getting anywhere. They do eventually go away. I think no one's had verrucas all their life, but they can be really annoying when they're there, to be honest.
And they can get sore.
They can get quite sore, especially on the feet. So they're basically warts. But the problem is when they're on your foot and you're walking, it gets embedded, it gets pushed in.
Yeah.
So warts on hands are much easier to treat than warts on feet, which are actually verruca.
Okay. And often picked up at the swimming pool? Or is that just the case?
Warts are a contagious virus. So in an area, obviously, where you're walking and, you know, warm, moist environment, you know, these kind of things flourish.
Okay. Yeah. Because I found it an absolute rigmarole
they can be
with the kit.
Yeah.
that I bought several times in the pharmacy, you know, filing day. It's the maintenance on it.
Yeah, I don't want to knock the companies making them, but I usually say to people, look, don't buy the home freeze kit. Go and buy the stuff you paint on, the old-fashioned salicylic acid. You got to stick with it. You got to keep doing it. Funnily enough, there was a study that actually looked at duct tape and that if you actually cover it, leave it for a week, then change it and do that for several months. It also works. It traps the oxygen out of the wart.
Right.
But obviously there are certain parts of the body that are easier to put duct tape on. The soles of your feet, not so easy. Certainly your toes, not so easy. But yeah, so it's just consistency in the treatment.
And if it's not going away, it's a trip to the GP where they can blast it off.
They can give a freeze. And what I used to do with some patients is they'd come in, we'd pare it down, we'd freeze it. I'd tell them leave it a few days and then I'd say go home and use the topical stuff now in between. Stop that 2 days before you come back to me. Come back, we'll pare it down, we'll freeze it again. But it is, you know, you sometimes do have to go at them for quite a while. Like mm-hmm. They don't go away in a week or two.
No, they don't. You need to kind of know what you're getting into. And I think the GP solution is actually a much better
Even
one.
Just to get some advice and just consistency with them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it needs to be blasted a couple of times to really get rid of it.
Yeah, no, I don't like blasting young kids because it's sore. So when parents come in to me with someone under the age of 8 or 9, I say, look, I don't like to do what is a potentially painful procedure in a child unnecessarily.
Okay.
Because they end up hating us. Yeah. They don't want to come back. So, you know, the topical stuff doesn't hurt. So I do say always give that stuff a really good go first. Don't do it for a week or two. Give that a good go before you decide to go for something that might actually hurt
them. So that's like stage two, I suppose. Yeah. Okay. Next question. My husband has been taking 20 milligrams of lurxandipine.
Lurkinidipine, is it?
That's it.
Yeah, it's a blood pressure tablet.
Hydrochloride for high blood pressure for 3 years. He takes it first thing in the morning. It says on the notes included that it causes frequent urination, but I noticed that since he's been on it, he urinates almost every hour. He will not tell the doctor about this. I'm worried that he could have prostate problems as well. Is this too frequent to urinate? He's 63.
Is it lurkinidipine hydrochlorothiazide? Is it a combination drug he's on?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's a combination drug. It has two drugs in it. So one of them is a diuretic, which is a water tablet. So most people, when they take a diuretic, they will go frequently for several hours after, but not all day. But obviously in any man who is passing urine frequently, you shouldn't just put it down to your medication. I agree with her. It's very important. He goes along, has a chat with his doctor, can have the prostate checked and some tests done. It may end up being the water tablet, but, you know, better to know rather than just assume.
And often it's the female who'll observe the behaviour.
No, it's often. An awful lot of men who come in, the first thing they'll say when they sit down is, my wife told me to come see you.
Okay.
You know, but it's important that, you know, we address our own health concerns. And I think sometimes maybe men feel that they shouldn't be asking for help or going along. So, but, you know, you've as much a right to go and get checked over any symptoms you're worried
about. Of course, listen to the clever people in your life. I fell feet first down the stairs 2 weeks ago and caught my foot on the banister rails. I'm 99.9% sure I broke my second to last toe. I didn't get it checked as I broke the same toe on the other foot before and was just given Diphene and told nothing can be done. It's still pretty swollen 2 weeks later, but manageable if I take ibuprofen in the morning. Should I get it checked or will it settle? No pain in foot, just lower knuckle of toe. Very specific details there.
Well, if it's still very swollen and sore, yeah. I mean, 2 weeks later, it could just be bad bone bruising. It sounds like a nasty fall, to be honest. You know, you want to make sure it's not a bone break along the main part of the foot. So, you know, if you're worried enough to ring and worry 2 weeks later, I guess someone would need to examine
it. It's not going away.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. If it's a simple break along some of the toes, unfortunately, we can't always do anything, but it's still worth checking these things.
Of course it is. Okay. Dr. Nina Burns, GP at Generation Health Medical Clinic. Lots more next week, no doubt, because the text lines are hopping. Thank you very much, as always. Great advice.
Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan.
With insurancebroker.ie.
Weekdays at midday on News Talk.